Any thoughts? What do you think of when you think of healing?
Therapy.
Therapy, okay, good. Anybody else? Pain. Mm-hmm.
Redemption.
Redemption. I heard a voice in the back.
Band-Aids.
Band-Aids, okay, good. Scabs. Good. Think apparently my ears need healing. So this past week when I set out to write my homily, halfway through it, I realized that I was angry, I was sad, I was depressed to the point where I was numb from the news of the tragedy inflicted on the LGBT community last weekend, from the response to some of our politicians, their current presidential election, and this past year filled with racism and police brutality. And I couldn't pinpoint the depression and the sadness, and there was this sense of numbness. And then I stumbled onto these words from Sarah Miles.
So, you know, I work a lot, doing pastoral care. So I work with a lot of people who are sick or dying or crazy or going through a horrible divorce or, you know, any of the million ways that we know how to suffer and make each other suffer. And one of the things that I've come to understand through doing this with other people, through praying with other people, through doing healing prayer with other people, is that healing is not the same thing as curing. Curing is about fixing or managing or solving a problem. Healing doesn't necessarily look like what we want it to look like. Healing happens on God's time, and it's possible to not be cured, but to be healed. You know, I think of people who've died in great pain and really great sickness, and yet have found a way to be restored to some kind of reconciled life with their family in the middle of that. More importantly, I think when somebody is healed, they're never healed by themselves. They're healed into community, because the real healing that God's always doing is restoring creation to order, right? And that's the work we participate in when we're doing healing prayer. So the people that we cast out because they're blind, or they're crippled, or they're crazy, God is yearning to pull them back into the whole, so that the whole can be healed. Not just so that the blind person can see, but so that the sighted ones can have the experience of being an undivided community. And healing prayer, because it happens with the whole community, is always about participating in that work of restoration that God is about. And it doesn't always fix problems, right? It doesn't always make everybody happy. It doesn't always cure somebody's cold, you know? It doesn't cure anything. Prayer doesn't cure anything, but prayer heals. Because as I said, it's like prayer is about relationship. And as we get pulled more deeply into relationship with God and into relationship with God's people, we become wholer as the whole becomes wholer, even when we're sick as dogs.
And so I stumbled onto her words. She says, healing is not the same thing as curing. Curing is about fixing or managing or solving a problem. Healing doesn't necessarily look like what we want it to look like. Healing happens on God's time. And it's possible to not be cured, but to be healed. And so as I was writing this, I realized why I was so frustrated. I was so angry that I wanted to fix. I wanted to fix this world, that I couldn't watch or listen or read about the news anymore, that my anger had turned into cynicism, which turned into numbness, because I wanted to fix them. They were the problem. This world needed fixing. And then I heard Sarah say, when someone is healed, they're never healed by themselves. They are healed into community. Because the real healing that God is always doing is restoring creation to order. The people that we cast out because they're blind or crippled or crazy, God is yearning to pull them back into the whole so that the whole can be healed. Not just so the blind person can see, but the sighted ones can have the experience of being in an undivided community. And so I realized that in me wanting to fix them and their problems, and then I read Wendell Berry's words, who said this, that the grace that is the health of creatures can only be held in common. In healing, the scattered members come together. In health, the flesh is graced. The holy enters the world. And so this morning, Vox, this morning, friends, this is my homily as a confession. I confess that my understanding of God's original vision isn't big enough, that I don't envision a world where Democrats and Republicans can be healed into community. I can't envision a world where certain politicians who've alienated the Latino and Muslim community can be healed together, where homophobes and the LGBT community who has suffered such great loss are healed into community. A world where someone like me, who can sit behind the safety of a computer and read and cry and repost and comment and preach and ignore my own self-righteous indignation, can be healed together with the victims and perpetrators and the politicians. I confess that I don't have a worldview big enough and a God loving enough where the blind and the sighted can experience an undivided community. And so this morning, friends, my homily as a confession, because I hope, I long to be healed into community. And so this morning, through a demonized individual in our story, a confession and a longing of hope. And so as is our custom, please read with me the end of the story, Luke chapter 8, verses 34 to 35, and we'll have it on the screen. So in our story, Jesus gets off a boat, and he meets a person who's disturbed and has been labeled as disturbed and demonized. And he's often chained based on his behavior, in verse 27. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but he lived in among the tombs. And then he begs Jesus to not do the thing that everyone had been doing to him. "Don't torment me," he said. When he saw Jesus, he cried out, fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, and says, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had commanded the impure spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him. And though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains. The chains didn't work. They kept chaining him. He kept unbreaking them and been driven out by the demons into solitary places. And so I'd like to give a possible reading on this. This isn't the only way to read this story, but I think it's a reasonable one. In a primitive and tribal world, things often feel magical. When you don't have access to information and science wasn't available, so a lot of the world didn't make sense. And if we were in their shoes, we'd probably say similar things. And when you don't understand something, you label something as supernatural. Let me give you an example. I've told you before that my father's family is from the south of rural China. My grandfather was a doctor and they were middle-class landowners. When the Mao regime rose to power, they tried to take our family's land and my grandfather resisted. The result, he had to flee for his life. And so for the last 40 years of my grandparents' life, they didn't talk to each other. In the safety of Hong Kong, my father wanted to talk to my grandmother, so he arranged for the first telephone to be brought into the rural village. They had never seen a phone. So the family gathered around to witness the event. They hadn't spoken for years, and finally the phone rings. They hand my grandmother the phone, which she had never held before. She hears my grandfather's voice. The blood drains from her face, her eyes widen. She throws the phone across the room and yells, "It's a ghost!" She didn't understand it, so it felt otherworldly. So I propose a possible reading. Again, this isn't the only way to read this. Is that things we don't understand, we label as magical or supernatural. My confession, part one. I'm the people in this story who demonize and isolate when there's something I don't understand. When someone displays negative behavior, my reaction is no different than what these people did to the poor man. They demonized him and they isolated him, and it didn't work. The chains kept breaking. I do this again and again, even when behavioral science shows the isolation is probably most likely compounding the problem. Here's a clip that shows it's from Research Addiction, which does research with mice, and if they're isolated, they're more drawn to addiction, and then they transfer that same theory to human beings. So check out the clip.
It's not the chemicals, it's your cage. We need to think about addiction differently. Human beings have an innate need to bond and connect. When we are happy and healthy, we will bond with the people around us. But when we can't, because we're traumatized, isolated, or beaten down by life, we will bond with something that gives us some sense of relief. It might be endlessly checking a smartphone, it might be pornography, video games, Reddit, gambling, or it might be cocaine. But we will bond with something because that is our human nature. The path out of unhealthy bonds is to form healthy bonds, to be connected to people you want to be present with. Addiction is just one symptom of the crisis of disconnection that's happening all around us. We all feel it. Since the 1950s, the average number of close friends an American has been steadily declining. At the same time, the amount of floor space in their homes has been steadily increasing. To choose floor space over friends, to choose stuff over connection. The war on drugs we've been fighting for almost a century now has made everything worse. Instead of helping people heal and getting their life together, we have cast them out from society. We have made it harder for them to get jobs and become stable. We take benefits and support away from them if we catch them with drugs. We throw them in prison cells, which are literally cages. We put people who are not well in a situation that makes them feel worse and hate them for not recovering. For too long, we've talked only about individual recovery from addiction. But we need now to talk about social recovery, because something has gone wrong with us as a group. We have to build a society that looks a lot more like Rat Park and a lot less like those isolated cages. We are going to have to change the unnatural way we live and rediscover each other. The opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection.
And so this morning I confess that even with this knowledge that the demonization, isolation are simply compounding the problem, I would agree with this in theory, but in this past year, police brutality, Islamophobes, homophobes, certain unnamed politicians, NRA lobbyists. I don't know any of these people, but based on second and third hand reports of their external behavior, I demonize and I isolate, even though the results don't work. The chains don't change a thing. And so perhaps this week, two suggested spiritual practices. The first, what if we practice connecting to someone in our life that's difficult? And instead of demonizing and isolating, what if we engage the divine frontal part of our brain and connected with the Christ in each person, like Stefan's icon from last week? Practice number two. What if we stop demonizing and isolating our own negative behavior? What if we saw negative behavior as not shameful, but perhaps useful biological signal? In the same way, when we get thirsty because we lack water, we get hungry because we lack food. We get addicted when we lack connection. And what if we learn to read these signals and these signs so that we stop demonizing and isolating? And then in verse 30, Jesus engages with the demonized man. And this is perhaps the first conversation this man has had with any human in decades. And then in verse 30, Jesus asks him, "What is your name?" "Legion," he replied. Jesus asks him his name, and he identifies with his demons. "Legion," he says. Some historians read that this is a commentary on the Roman occupation of their land. Like soldiers of the empire, he's been occupied with an abusive and controlling power. Others say that legion is simply a statement of the multiplicity and the complexity of the problem. And so my confession, part two. Like the isolated man, I am the one possessed. I am the one in need of Christ to swing open the doors of my closet, to name my demons. that my demons are not my name nor my identity, to discover my truest name in love. So what might these demons be? This is what Richard Rohr says. We are all addicts. Human beings are addictive by nature. Addiction is a modern name and an honest description for what the biblical tradition called sin, and medieval Christians called passions or attachments. They both recognize that serious measures or practices were needed to break us out of these illusions and entrapments. In fact, the New Testament calls them in some cases exorcisms. They knew they were dealing with a non-rational evil or demons. Substance addictions like alcohol and drugs are merely the most visible form of addiction, but actually we are all addicted to our own habitual way of doing anything, our own defenses, and especially our patterned way of thinking and how we process our reality. The very fact we have to say this shows how much we are blinded inside of it. By definition, you can never see or handle what you are addicted to. It is always hidden and disguised as something else. As Jesus did with the demon at Gerasea, which is our story this morning, someone must say, "What is your name?" The problem must be correctly named before the demon can be exorcised. You cannot heal what you do not first acknowledge. And like this demonized man, if left to my own devices, I will run to isolation unknowingly. I will run to isolation unconsciously, drawn back to my addictions, to live among the dead, perhaps thinking those are the only stories that control and name me. I was recently listening to an interview by Mark Maron. He was interviewing Louis C.K. And they were talking about his new show, Horace and Pete. And Louis started talking about how intense the writing and the acting became. And he played a character in this new series that it abuses everyone he knows. And he said at one point, it was so emotional for him, it was so intense, that he almost had to replace himself with another actor. And halfway through the filming, he realized that he had written his character to be his own father that he grew up who abused him. His own father that he doesn't have a relationship with. And his only one sister who stays in touch, even though she has a hard time with their father. And so as they were filming, he went up to his sister and asked her, "Why do you do that? Why do you keep in touch even though it's so hard?" And she said, "Well, he's a part of me. Your parents are a part of you. I feel like if I can accept him, not even forgive or like him, if I can be open to him in my life, I can be open to parts of myself that I have a hard time dealing with." And Louis said that was such a strong choice, a choice that he can't make because he'd rather shut down and avoid. And in one particular scene, Louis describes his abusive character, hearing that his son now is grown and healthy and happy. And in that scene, he had to shoot it 3 times, and each of the times, he would wail and he would bawl. And as Mark Maron listened to Louis explaining his process, Mark Maron asked him, "When you look at this thing, what you wrote and acted in this play," he asked, "do you feel like you exercised something?" And Louis C.K. said, "It wasn't until I wrote this and acted in it that I was able to name it, and the process was healing for him." And so like this demonized man, I need the grace of Christ to lovingly and mercifully name my demons, my addictions. I need to trust Paul's words that strength is found in the most vulnerable places of my life, to relentlessly trust Christ represented in the body of the church, to allow the church to call out God's beautiful vision in me and in all of us, to be reminded again and again who we are is enough to be known, enough to be loved, and to be named and renamed by that love. And the Darwinian voices of earning and striving, the oppressive chains in the form of voices to be more successful, more beautiful, more charismatic, more impressive, leave us to live isolated among the dead. I need to be renamed like Paul and Peter and Sarah and Abraham so that I don't die before I'm actually dead, so that I can live life that's eternal, timeless, to the fullest now. Then in the story, the demons are thrown into the lowliest animal of their tribe, the pig. The pigs ran off a cliff to drown into the lake, and the demons that haunted him his whole life no longer controlled him, no longer possessed his identity, his name, his behavior. And in verse 34, when those tending the pigs saw what had happened, they ran off and they reported this in the town and the countryside. And then the people went to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and they saw him and this man doing something so profoundly and beautifully ordinary. He was clothed and sitting. And somehow this terrified the town. And then the man begged to go with Jesus. And then Jesus' instructions contradicted what we talked about last week, where Jesus tells his disciples not to talk. And in this story, he tells this newly unpossessed free man to go back into his community and talk. Verse 39, he says, "Return home and tell how much God has done for you." And perhaps Christ's genius is what behavioral science is only learning centuries later, that the source of his addiction and possession was not behavior, but rather connection. And in reconnecting him to his town, the man was not only continuing his own healing process, but beginning to bring healing to the entire community as well. My confession, part three. I am the townspeople who prefers to demonize a scapegoat in order to avoid my own addictions. Who, as long as there is someone more socially acceptable, whose demons are less socially acceptable to point out, I can use this person as a shield to hide behind. I was listening to an interview with the late Gary Shandling recently. And in this interview, he talked about the hypocrisy of America's relationship with Charlie Sheen. He said several years ago, when Charlie Sheen was melting down, all of America was talking about him, writing about him, reading about him. They couldn't stop watching him and shaking their heads and judging him. And he thinks that Sheen was simply mirroring back to America, who at that time was going through a financial crisis, was addicted to power and success. And as long as they both could keep yelling winning as loud as they could, they were somehow winning. And as long as America has a Charlie Sheen to demonize, they never have to look at themselves. And I, like the townspeople, have a sophisticated methodology of finding the appropriate scapegoat. As long as I can demonize, I can keep my own demons in my own closet. And in this story, the demonized scapegoat is healed back into his community to continue his healing and begin their healing. The healing they've been avoiding as long as they could point to his problems. Perhaps Jesus already knew what Wendell Berry wrote centuries later. And he says, healing is impossible in loneliness. It is the opposite of loneliness. Conviviality is healing. To be healed, we must come with all the other creatures to the feast of creation. And so, Vox, this morning, this is my confession. I confess because I trust that there is good news. And in this week of tragedy, in this year of chaos, I desperately hope, and long for good news. I need to hear the good news that Christ invites me to unchain my isolation and shame. As he unchains my isolation, he sees me for my truest self, and then invites me to take the chains off of my enemies, the politicians, the homophobes, the Islamophobes, the police brutalizers. This is the good news, that my isolation is only freed with the reconnection of all people. That I am not free until we are all free. And friends, this is the good news, that I am possessed in ways that I can't even see or name, that I'm still blinded by my tormented history, the trauma of my family story, my people's story, the wounds of my fundamentalist story. If I had a choice, I would run again and again to live among those tombs. And like this man, I need a savior to call me out of the grave, to free me from my addiction. I need a healer to rename me into God's original vision of beauty and creativity and wonder. And I am the one who Christ comes to with only love, without judgment, refusing to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and instead eats from the fruit of the spirit of love and joy and peace and patience. And friends, this is the good news, that I am the townspeople who in their smug blindness projected their addictions and trauma onto one man so that I can hide behind my addictions and isolate myself in my laptop of moral superiority. Only until Christ sends my other to tell me the really good story of good news for all, the demonizers and the demonized. And friends, this is the great news, that God shows himself and comes as a gentle and loving scapegoat, a scapegoat nailed to a cross to understand and stand with our pain. And as death is resurrected, so our addictions and violence and shame can be resurrected to new life, renamed, repossessed by love itself. And the good news is the word that we've used for afterlife insurance, that's been often translated as saved, is probably better translated as healed. And in this world of violence, on this morning of confession, we're all in need of healing that comes from these words of John, who says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only scapegoat, that whoever believes in him shall not live among the tombs, but live a life that's timeless and eternal, that transcends time. For God did not send his son into the world to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but to heal us into community through him." And friends, this is the good news of the Lord. Thanks be to God. If you could, please pray with me.
Rubbing salt into fresh wounds, pressing into bloodied skin with alcohol-soaked rags. This is equal parts carnal flinch and spinal jolt, equal parts willful heart and trembling hand, a sheep in wolf's clothing. I press deep, wondering where the pain will go when it leaves my body. Where does the pain go when it leaves us? I speak with sunlight language, but I do not mean to romanticize the nights in which my weeping lasted long enough to call the sun from its absence. I've been here long enough to gather just a little bit, and in this time I've managed to gather just enough to comprehend the language of the silent saints around us. There's not much to their silence apart from my lack of focus. There is much to be spoken on behalf of their minor key moans and belabored bellows, which speak to a pain so storied, an injury so ancient that we have written it everywhere and thus can no longer read it. Brother Isaac taught us two scriptures regarding these silent saints, which you must truly hear first before you are able to read them everywhere. One, for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. Two, no thing ever in this beautiful expanse of matter has ever been destroyed so much as it has been transformed, meaning your pain will not disappear and it will not be destroyed and it will not be as if it had never existed, but the ancient scriptures insist that it will decompose into fragments of itself, and so long as there is life and time, it will be incorporated into everything around it, and therefore it is how we restructure these fragments of pain that matters most. We have decided to turn this nightclub crime scene into a library. My incredible mother has decided to turn immigrant grit in full capacity 2002 Ford Escorts in Texas Julys into college degrees. We have beaten our swords into plowshares. We have decided to remember Kevin Brown. I have decided to remember only joy from my childhood. We will remember to make a monument to the wars we have fought, for we will waste nothing. In light of this, we will also make a monument to the peace that we have fashioned from scraps of agony. When salt is poured into the wound, metal ions catalyze enzymes that break down necrotic tissue, meaning salt helps to break down the broken tissue, which will ultimately be repurposed for growth, meaning that it facilitates a healing, a transformation in accordance with the rules of life and time, and it will not feel good. Do not allow me to romanticize the nights in which your weeping lasted long enough to call the sun from its absence, but please, as you are able, rub the salt into your wounds with a willful heart and a trembling hand, and with a smile of the soul that can only come from the sweet playfulness of hope. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost.